is a platform for you. So please reach out to us if you want to hear, if you want a spot on the show, if you want to talk about your podcast.
Welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African current affairs and analysis brought to you by, well, today by Heldon, Doug, and myself, Gwen, each from the safety of our separate homes. Heldon, what are you going to be doing tonight?
Yes, hi, Gwen. It's always lovely to see you guys. And I really can't wait to get back to the studio.
Yeah.
Just for some reasons to see you guys.
Yeah.
So, but last week I started by doing small reviews of different news that is coming from the continent, and I'll be doing three brief ones again for this week. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Fabulous. And Doug, what about you?
Well, I've got a little short on Pata Pata. A new version has come out that Pata Pata was touched by Miriam Makeba, and we'll play a little bit of that. And then I'll be joining Heldon as we walk through news about the continent and what's going on there. And okay, good news, Club Ballet 2 is open tomorrow.
Ooh, okay. And I had the great opportunity to have quite a broad-ranging conversation with Devlin Kuyak, who is a member of GRAIN, because we've been doing a lot of COVID-related stories, and it occurred to me a few days ago, what is land grabbing in Africa looking like in the era of COVID? And Devlin is always a wonderful interview, and it's an issue that he and I revisit once or twice a year. So yesterday we had a good long talk about that and many other things. So stay tuned for Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM.
Saturday.
that, dear listeners, is Pata Pata by Miri Makeba, a song that I know for many, many, many years. Miriam only died a few years back and was singing up until then. That version that you just listened to was from AVO Sessions, which is a festival in Basel, Switzerland, from 2006. So it was when she was quite senior, and but she still had that verve and that energy, and she was radiant in her elder status as a woman, grandmother, often traveling, in fact, with grandchildren, playing in the entourage with her. So what could be closer to a senior heart than make them happy than having your grandchildren around you as you sing? I first heard that song in 1967 at African parties at Carleton University, and her songs and all her music remain part of my life and eventually my growing family's musical lexicon, to the extent that my son named his daughter Zinzili in her honor. Well, now Angelika Kidjo has put out a version of Pata Pata. Pata Pata means in Zulu, touch, and in the dance when you did it involved a certain amount of coming into contact with each other and passing the hands up and down the figure. It was very sensuous and very fun, and so the COVID crisis, of course, is don't touch, and it's time rather than touch, it's don't touch. And in Kijo's song, she includes lines such as, "It's time to sit it out. This is no Pata Pata. Stay at home and wait it out. We need to keep our hands clean. Don't touch your face. Keep distance, please." So the version, as UNICEF put it out, was so popular that they asked people around the world to film themselves dancing to the song in their homes and gardens and wherever, and send it to them, tagged at UNICEF Africa, with the hashtag no Pata Pata. And many of them then were included in the video, which you can get on YouTube under UNICEF, or go to the UNICEF site to see it. And so it's very interesting. So here is Angelika Kidjo's version of Pata Pata, don't touch version.
Welcome, friends. I'm UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador Angelika Kidjo. And tonight, we are going around the world for UNICEF Won't Stop.
Again.
as I was saying in the introduction, I was able to have a conversation with Devlin Kuyek yesterday. He is a member of GRAIN, which is a small international nonprofit that works to support small farmers and social movements in their struggle for community-controlled and biodiversity-based food systems. And for those of you who do not know GRAIN, I would certainly encourage you to go and check out their website. They have just some fantastic documentation. And Devlin has, over the years, really become our go-to person when it comes to talking about land grabbing in Africa, which is a huge issue that has ramped up over the last just over a decade, I guess. I wanted to talk to him about what land grabbing looks like under COVID, because as we have discussed on our show, and for those of you who've been following Feroz Manji's series, Organizing in the Time of COVID, COVID represents a moment, an important moment that could be an opportunity for transformative, progressive change. We're seeing that possibility there. Or it could be an opportunity for the consolidation of power by those who already hold it. So Devlin and I take a look at that in the context of land grabbing in Africa, but as is always the case in my conversations with Devlin, they become very wide-ranging conversations, but always interesting. So here's Devlin Kuyek of GRAIN. Devlin Kuyek, it's so nice to have you back here on Amandla.
Thank you, Gwen. It's wonderful to be back.
Well, as you know, you and I have a ritual. Once or twice a year, we revisit the whole issue of land grabbing in Africa. And over the last couple of days, I've gotten to thinking about the impact of COVID on land grabbing. And that's what I'd like us to focus on tonight. But before we go there, I would like you to draw a bit of a portrait for our listeners of this phenomenon, for those who aren't really familiar with it. And I think I can say that while we can argue that land grabbing has existed since colonialism and was its very essence in certain colonies, over the last couple of decades, it's really ramped up. So could you talk to us about what's driving this more recent wave of land dispossession?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of it is so much so connected to the colonial history, so it's hard to even just separate it. But yeah, we are talking a bit about a particular phenomenon that started over 10 years ago now, where you had this confluence of a financial crisis at that time, so another big economic crisis, and a food crisis. So there was a really rapid increase in the price of food globally, especially for certain basic commodities like wheat and rice. A lot of the crops actually that many African countries import. And that created this trend where you had certain governments, so like Gulf country governments, I mean, Korea at the time, Japan, countries where they have a lot of dependence on food imports, but they're quite cash rich. They lost faith in the market and began looking at ways that they could get, you know, more control over those imports, and they started looking to acquire huge areas of farmland in different countries where, you know, there was this sense that there was abundant lands, fertile lands and water resources. And of course, a lot of African countries were targeted. But that wasn't the only phenomenon. There was also, with the financial crisis, a lot of the big investors, financial companies that invest in stocks started looking for alternative investments, you know, pension funds as well, started looking for alternative investments to the stock market and began to look at farmland as this kind of new asset class where they could park their money in a place that would be safe and that would give some returns over time and then would be correlated to stocks and various things. So you had this surge of cash also going into the acquisition of farmland and all these funds that were being set up to be able to, you know, source, find farmland and package it up and sell it on to these investors. And there too, Africa was heavily targeted. And then you had the, you know, the the agribusiness companies, a lot of these sort of plantation companies, who took in some of that new money that was coming in, and also just have their own sort of expansionist agenda. You know, there's always demand for more things like palm oil and the basic kind of raw materials that go into all our processed foods. And that's really, really been increasing over the last decades. And so that too is driving interest in expanding the production of these commodities in Africa. So that's put a lot of pressure on land. It's created a lot of incentive for governments in Africa to sell off their lands to these foreign companies. And it's created really dire situation for many communities where they're just violently evicted from their lands to make them available to these foreign investors. And that, I would say, like, you had a kind of peak of that happening around, say, 2012, 2013. It's somewhat tapered off in the last years, partly, I think, because of the resistance of African communities, combined with allies and from the civil society sector, both nationally and internationally. But also, we're quite worried that this new situation now, with another economic crisis, mm-hmm. Yet to be seen, but very likely, crash of the stock market again. Mm-hmm. A lot of the institutional investors, so-called institutional investors, these are like big hedge funds or big pension funds or sovereign wealth funds, those who really hold most of the money in the financial world, that they will start looking at farmland again, and that you'll get another push in that direction.
Well, that certainly is begging my next question. So what you're referring to is, I think, some of the spin-off or economic impact of the pandemic. So let's shift our gaze to that. I don't know about you, but I've been fairly closely following Feroz Manji's series called Organizing in the Time of COVID, and he has spoken to people all over the world. And, you know, depending on who you speak to, and sometimes even depending on the day you speak to them, it's a crisis that either opens the door to the potential for profound progressive change as social and economic inequalities are laid bare in ways that maybe for some people they've never seen them before. So it raises a certain level of consciousness, and there's that possibility for mass mobilization and a rebuilding of our world in a more just way. So that's one interpretation. The other one that you just alluded to is that, in fact, what COVID represents is an opportunity for those who hold the balance of power and wealth to consolidate it. So of course that ties directly back into land grabbing. So let's look at it through that lens, and that's your sense of the impact of the pandemic on the struggle over control of land.
Oh, that's a really good way that you just framed it. We put out a paper today that was published in the latest edition of the World Rainforest Movement's. They do a monthly bulletin. I encourage all your listeners to subscribe to it. It's fantastic. It has a lot of good information on Africa as well. But the title was Agro-Imperialism in the Time of COVID. And it brings together a lot of just what we're seeing as far as how agribusiness and the large companies that dominate the food sector are so brutally using this time to advance their interests in such a naked way. So as you say, like all the myths that surround this are kind of laid bare. Like, you know, the there's 400,000 workers in the Brazilian agribusiness industry who are now seem to be thought to be affected by COVID-19. Similar numbers in the U.S., you know, in terms of the meat plants and the migrant worker camps where, you know, people working in the strawberry fields and in Quebec as well.
Yes,
you know,
I was going to say, yeah, as a PS, you know, that's here too.
And in the meat plants here as well. And, you know, these and just, you know, who's impacted there, you know. This industry that has thrived on the most vulnerable labor that has been engaged in union busting activities, that has, you know, developed models of production that just, I mean, the treatment of animals, the land, biodiversity, and notably what we're seeing more than anything now too is the treatment of the workforce, the workers, is just so despicable. And in the end, I mean, was one very good case, I think, of with the meat plants and just how the role that they have played in the transmission of the disease. But then how those companies who continue to pay their executives and shareholders these huge dividends have that been saying that they're so necessary to the food security of the countries where they're operating. So in the case of the U.S., you know, they had Tyson take out a full page ad saying, Tyson's one of the largest meat producers in the U.S., saying, you know, how vital they were to the food security of the country. Meanwhile, there a huge amount of what they were producing was going to China, where the prices of meat have gone up because of another pandemic there with the pig sector. But completely disconnected, and it's so visible for anybody to see how ruthless and how wrong this industry is. And on one hand, it gives you hope that okay, now you know there's this like momentum and chance for workers to organize, for communities to come and support workers, and we've seen that happening, you know, time and time again, in places like. To go on about the U.S. here, but there's one case in this community where there's a Smithfield, it's a big, huge pork producing company. The Smithfield plant and the communities were out at the real height of the pandemic. People from the communities out on a car protest, demanding that there be investigations into what was happening in the worksite and standing in solidarity with the workers. And of course, couple days later, it emerges that there's this mass outbreak happening in this meat plant, and then all meat plants across the country, and all meat plants everywhere. And in Africa, this is something that just isn't being investigated. It hasn't been investigated in places like Ecuador, where you have these huge export industries, say in the shrimp sector, right in Guayaquil, where one of the worst outbreaks in the world has happened. And we know for sure that it's deeply, those industries are deeply infested. Brazil is a case now where it's just completely out of control. There was a case in Ghana where there was a tuna factory, a Thai company that produces canned tuna. Or there was an outbreak. It was, I think, accounted for a third of all cases in Ghana. So, this industry is integrated in the transmission of the disease. It's integrated in the origins of the disease. Mm-hmm. So pandemics, we know one of the main sources of pandemics is either coming from deforestation, where you get this, where humans are disturbing the habitats of wild animals and coming into contact, or it's coming into factory farms where you have thousands and thousands of uniform animals piled on top of each other, and it creates the perfect condition for the emergence of disease, mm-hmm. as we saw with the swine flu back in 2009 in Mexico, whose potential that this pandemic even has is some way connected. In the origins, in the transmission, and then in the consequences, where you're really not producing food for people. Most of the food that people get in this world is produced by small scale producers. It's provided through local markets. It's provided by people in the so-called informal sector, mm-hmm. all of whom are outside of any protection from the policies that the governments have put forward. And this industry, which is a very powerful industry, time and time again gets protected in this case. So in the case of the US, Trump came in with this executive order that forced the meat plants to stay open, even though, that was a major source of transmission and it was deadly for the workers. Throughout Latin America, where COVID is rampant in this industry, you're seeing, again, everything being done to make sure the exports continue, to make sure that the plants and factories stay open, that the ports stay open. You're getting regulations are being removed to make sure that they can access pesticides and spray more pesticides on the crop. So, I mean, the communities are impacted in so many ways from what's happening right now.
Yeah.
As you were saying, there's these two sides. And on that one side, you see all these the reality of this industry is laid bare. And on the other hand, there's a push to entrench it more deeply, and all those power structures that have led to this industry bearing where it is today are sort of pushing that forward. So you can see it in very subtle ways, like in case in Uganda, for instance. There's these communities who are being evicted from their lands. Now, the evictions predate COVID, but there's sort of like this real conflict happening right now, and the communities are trying to stay on the land. But during the COVID crisis, when even though the government had said that, you know, that there should be a stop of all evictions and all when it comes to land, the companies involved here have been able to act with impunity, and have even with these orders in place, have been evicting, you know, hundreds of villagers, mm-hmm. In very violent ways, in cahoots with the police. You know, there's torture, there's arrests that are happening. And there's one of the organizations we work with there helped to organize a legal team to go visit some of the villagers who are trying to mount a case. And seven lawyers went there, and they were all arrested along with the community leaders and charged for violating the COVID-19 restrictions on movement and gathering. Mm. Yeah. And it was only a lot of international pressure, I think, that allowed them to be released on bail. So it's, you know, and that you see playing out all over the place. I mean, it's just one example.
Yes, well, definitely. We have seen lots of evidence of how state forces have really ramped up the repression under COVID. A lot of settling of unsettled scores and violation of human rights under the guise of COVID. So it's definitely seems to be a major factor in how a lot of this is playing itself out. But let's try to look at this from another angle, which is that, you know, so many people in Africa have been dispossessed of their land for generations, and or by default dispossessed of their land because neocolonial economies have not valued the production, or have undermined the value of peasant and farmer production. And so we've seen massive urbanization, the explosion of the informal sector, people's loss of access to their ancestral lands. And so in a situation like COVID, where informal workers are being told they need to stay home, they can't go out, they'll become vectors for the transmission of the disease, it's become a desperate situation for them. And so I guess my question is, and this might be hard for you to answer, but maybe, I know you have a lot of contacts on the continent around issues of land, is it fostering a sense of awareness that to be able to have that connection back to land is so essential for people's survival, to at least be able to produce some of your own food? I mean, informal sector workers, you know, are facing the threat of starvation if they don't go to work. And they're not being allowed to go to work. So is there the possibility of a kind of a resurgence of an awareness of the importance of having that land base?
Yeah, most of the African continent gets its food, for instance, from the informal sector. So, you know, supermarkets and these sort of more, what they call the more formal sector, provide very little when it comes to people's food. So if you shut down and lock down the informal sector, you're essentially starving people, moving them their livelihoods with starving people. And there have been very interesting struggles and initiatives that have come about in South Africa, a really strong effort, for instance, to have the informal sector recognized as, you know, one of the most important, or if not the most important,
as a formal sector,
as formal, exactly, and that any response needs to, you know, figure out ways to facilitate the functioning of the informal sector. You know, and in cases where But we've been pushing back a lot on this narrative that, oh, you know, these wet markets are to blame, for instance, in Asia for being the source and spread of the disease. Or a lot of people have said the same of markets in Latin America. But really, you know, these markets, many of them would have been numerous markets in different areas. With the explosion of the slum areas and the violent crackdown that usually happens on informal sellers, they get pushed to very like crowded areas as well. So the whole like way in which this sector has been treated so disdainfully, basically criminalized, has made it also very vulnerable to the situation. So part of the response has to be, how can we, you know, create a spaces and a food system and trade and distribution chains in the so-called informal sector that is safe? You know, that should be the assumption. But none of course, the World Bank and none of the development agencies, they have zero understanding of what that looks like. So it's meant also that people have to look elsewhere for solutions right now. And I think that's what's really interesting, is you're seeing this rise of sort of mutual aid or different initiatives that farmers are taking on themselves and connecting with urban groups. You're seeing a total mushrooming of that. And that is incredible. I think definitely people having a growing sense, you know, from what my colleagues and the people I know in Africa are telling me, that a growing sense of the importance of local food, the importance of having some more food sovereignty in the country, and the problems with this dependence on imports, and the dependence on these, you know, foreign companies that people don't no longer trust. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, one of our great worries right now is that there was an emerging debt crisis already. I don't know if you've talked about this on the show, but you know, there's been a huge increase over the last years in the amount of debt that is owed by countries in the global south. And much of that debt is owed to private creditors. So they can be pension funds, they can be BlackRock, it can be, you know, all kinds of different private sector companies. And with this economic crisis, and many of these are dollar denominated, so you're going to have this real difficulty for governments, it's already happening, to repay these debts. There will be a debt crisis, and those debts will be negotiated with not only the IMF and the World Bank, which is bad enough, but with these private lenders now. And the recipe is going to be the same as it always has been. It's going to be structural adjustment. It's going to be, you know, produce more export commodities to get these dollars so you can pay us off. Yep. And, you know, cut back on your healthcare and your social programs.
A consolidation of the status quo, or, you know, yes, the trend that's existed
for, and rapid sell off of natural resources and land. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be, I think, a huge conflict that's going to be building now. Is, you know, already it's hard enough to stomach what's being imposed. As this new second wave of structural adjustment comes in, what is that going to mean, and how are people going to organize to fight against this? It's going to require not just, you know, strong on-the-ground organizing, but also, I think, a lot of international solidarity. And we here, you know, we've talked about the investment of the pension funds in Quebec and Canada, and I think that's something we can start to look at. You know, are our pension funds invested in African debt right now? They probably are. Mm-hmm. Are they invested in the mining companies and others who are going to be taking advantage of this crisis? They most certainly are. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done here as well when it comes to that. I mean, we'll be facing our own issues, of course, but I mean, it's, you know, that's something that we have an intimate involvement in when it comes to what's going to be playing out in Africa.
It's a dark portrait, Devlin, and, you know, I always try to end on a positive point, but in a sort of interesting and strange way, it is a positive point in the sense that what you just said potentially empowers Quebecers and Canadians to take action here in solidarity with people struggling there. And, you know, so much of the problem does lie here, right, in our countries, in terms of all of these structural inequalities. And to be taking on the pension funds and drawing those connections between Canada and Africa and elsewhere in the world is positive in the sense that it can empower people to take action for change.
Yes, and you know, I think shatters also the sort of old development model that we had of aid. You know, that's clearly not what's at stake here. That Africa, in many ways, is facing the same issues that countries all over the world are facing. You know, the same kind of policies, just in some cases a much more dramatic way. Mm-hmm. But we all have the same fight and struggle ahead of us. So.
Devlin, it's always great chatting, even when it's very difficult issues, but your insights and knowledge are always really appreciated. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gwen.
My next guest's powerful new song, They Don't, addresses racial injustices in the wake of police brutality and national civil unrest. With proceeds donated to Until Freedom and to the Solidarity Fund, here are Nasty C and T.I.
Hey, they don't want me to win, they don't want me to eat. They don't wanna see a young black man succeed. They don't wanna see me take my brothers out of the streets. They don't want me. They don't want me to sleep, they don't want me to dream. They don't wanna see my people living good and at ease. They wanna lock them all up and then get rid of the kids. We ain't never free. Grateful for life and the prize I reap. Every day and every night I get on my knees and I pray for my guys and their families. Hope the Lord hear me. I can only imagine the pain and the grief from the innocent mothers they had to see. When you lose the ones you love to the police, it cuts deep. When heaven calls and the angels do their job, we start to question God like we could play his part. It gets so hard. We can't escape the dark. This hatred in my heart for the ones who left this scar. But everything will be alright soon. I just wanna let you know ain't nothing like you. We live and die, it's always been a cycle. I promise it wasn't about you. When you make it to heaven, give me your eyes, dude. Watch over me closely till it's my time, so the only thing I can do is turn to the Bible and do my best to help your family, cause it might too. But they don't want me to win, they don't want me to eat. They don't wanna see a young black man succeed. They don't wanna see me take my brothers out of the streets. They don't want me. They don't want me to sleep, they don't want me to dream. They don't wanna see my people living good and at ease. They wanna lock them all up and then get rid of the kids. We ain't never free.
How could you blame as many sisters and brothers die? If they answer to it, go and start another fight. Guess they got to do it, I guess it's your objection to it. God bless them, no direction, not they getting to it. 2020, guess it's the year to burn. Consequences you earn, the bitterest nation that you hate me and the karma's return. That's a stupid question, when will you learn? You never will, work the joy, Floyd, Emmett Till, and Sean Bell. Guess they rather see us all as civil and rare. Then they go and make some bread. Yeah, after that, it'll get exactly what you expect. How you pull the serve and protect with your knee on my neck? Ain't hard to see you not for me. The cycle of atrocity blew your cover. Now about to be some reciprocity. I'm with the cause, and it gon' be whatever it got to be. But vandalize a building, that's just not for me. But even still, if I'ma be real with you, bet they ain't got seen that police station going up in smoke. Felt like vindication for so many folk. Breonna Taylor, Sandra Bland, and so many.
They don't want me to win, they don't want me to eat. They don't wanna see a young black man succeed. They don't wanna see me take my brothers out of the streets. They don't want me. They don't want me to sleep, they don't want me to dream. They don't wanna see my people living good and at ease. They wanna lock them all up and then get rid of the kids. We ain't never free. They hold my hand, mama, I'm here for you. They think they took your son, but they put him right next to you. You're the strongest thing on this earth, you unbreakable. Plus you brought him into this earth, and you raised him too. Take a second off every day and get comfortable. Celebrate yourself for a change, cause you never do. With all the pressure from society, you always hiding. Go outside and show the world a better you. I know you worry sick about if I'ma make it homeless. Hey, you know cause of my color, life ain't gonna be easy. But I'ma be okay if I tell God I need. That's what you taught me without even knowing your teaching. So what I'm trying to say is you're the furthest from weak. And I sing your praises because you made me make the world.
world a better place for your seeds. How could anybody take them away from their queen?
I really hope that you enjoyed this this particular song, Nasty C featuring T.I., They Don't. It's a song that came out on June 24th as an effort to collect money towards the Black Lives Matter movement. Just to talk a bit about Nasty C, he's a 23-year-old rapper from South Africa. His full name is Nsikaye Sizwe David Junior Nkobo. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but
that's as close as we're going to get to close.
Exactly. So this Zulu young man has been raising some efforts to raise awareness about what's going on in his own hometown, which is KwaZulu-Natal. This man's music always brings forward that aspect of his life, how he grew up, and I just found that this was a very fitting song given the climate that we're in as the global dynamic is shifting towards just some realization or discussions about what has been denied to others in a bigger general sense.
And interesting that you come up with that, because on the 13th of July, Zinzi Mandela died, daughter of Nelson. And of course, she was very much a figure in the anti-apartheid struggle, a very important figure because of her mother. I mean, she was only like 5 or 6 years old when mother was rusticated to Brandfontein for being an opponent of the regime and standing up in Nelson's place and making a lot of noise and upsetting the regime. And so she saw firsthand how bad that it was under that. And I can't remember, I think she was only about 12 or 13 years old. She wrote a letter to the Director General, Secretary General of the United Nations to protest her mom's treatment, and that in fact, mom could not get letters out of her internal exile, and that she, Zinzi, was afraid for her mother's welfare because the regime was planning something horrible for her. Such an amazing position for a young person to be in, and it was truly tragic. She was only 59, and she'd been the ambassador to, I can't remember, Denmark, I think it was, for a few years, and was waiting for her next assignment when she passed away. There was no official declaration of what went wrong, what the illness was, but it's a tragic end and a sad end to a person whose life has been shaped by racism, by Black lives not mattering and or being abused, and who was a proud representative of her parents both for the struggle against apartheid and racism in South Africa.
Yes, and I just to mention that, I'm glad you brought in that parallel, Doug, because the first time that I heard about Zinzi Mandela was actually through her reading a speech, what would be her father giving it, and she like actually spoke out the words on his behalf. So for sure, a powerhouse that has been gone very soon, and our prayers and thoughts are with her family and friends.
Yes, it's truly sad, and she herself is already a grandmother and lost one of her grandchildren during the World Cup in South Africa. So it's truly a tough life that woman has had, and to pass away so early is sad. Hambakale to her, and go well in wherever you are now. Leads us to what's also happening in South Africa. The COVID rates have climbed astronomically. When we spoke with Dr. Abdul Karim about 3 weeks ago, maybe a month by now, it looked like they were getting things under control when they started opening the economy, and then the bars and clubs started opening, and boy, oh boy, did they go backwards fast. It's tragic.
It's very, and this also is not, it's not an isolated case. Even we could see it right here at home, where like they are opening up a lot of things, and we're just finding out that it's premature and we should have waited just a bit. So this is quite a very, it's one of those very like sad situations where we have to act fast. There is no more
Well, it's really the question of education, and Dr. Abdul Karim really pointed out how hard they had worked with all the resources they had to keep it under control. We thought we had it under control here, but obviously we hadn't reached the population that we wanted to or needed to avoid these kinds of things. The house parties on the South Shore were clear examples of folks just not really getting the message at all.
Yes, I agree, but I don't think the blame lies exclusively with the people. I think in the instance of the bars, certainly here in Montreal, where we're broadcasting from, we have a very, very powerful bar lobby, a very powerful industry lobby that clearly was successful in pressuring the government to authorize the reopening of bars, even though most people think it's completely crazy and premature. So, you know, it's... schools don't have that lobby, therefore they're still closed.
Well, absolutely. And in South Africa, the issue of alcohol, abolition of alcohol sales really did help, in fact, keeping people at home. But at the same time, South Africa has a long history of shebeens and illegal alcohol. And as mm-hmm. soon as it was banned, everything went underground. So yeah. It's complicated. But on the COVID issue, in early June, we got news that President Nkurunziza, oh boy, can you pronounce that for me, Helden?
Nkurunziza
died. And it was at the time claimed that it was a heart attack. Ironically, his wife, at the very time he died, was in Aga Khan Hospital in Nairobi being treated for COVID. 19, and it became very clear that in fact he was displaying all the symptoms himself. I won't get into the political history here because his rule has been very controversial. He started out off the back of a peace process that looked like he was going to lead a nice transition to democracy, but it declined radically and dramatically in the last election 2015. It's just been a horrible situation in Burundi with over 400,000 refugees out of the country now because of it. But he has been one of the major deniers in Africa, along with his neighbor in Tanzania, Magufuli. Oh, God will protect us. We've got a pact with God. It's going to keep our nation safe. Absolutely no measures taken whatsoever prevent COVID, no mask wearing, no closing down of events, no closing down of business, nothing. And holy smokes, boom, again, 59 years old, I don't think he was 60, and a terrible way to go. And this whole denier thing, where does this come from? Clearly.
It sparked a thought in my mind.
Would you repeat that, Helden?
I said it brings a thought to my mind of, I was reading at the beginning of June, like you mentioned, did you hear about I don't know what to call it, a portion of some sort that Madagascar president was pushing for or like putting in forth as something that would help with COVID. And I remember that Tanzania was one of the countries that did a mass buying of this portion. So when you talk about COVID deniers, that brings to mind that conversation. And I actually would like to follow up to see whatever happened to that specific Madagascar portion that was mixed, and if other countries have bought into it, and how that is just taken in a general sense. So.
Well, and in Burundi's case, the political instability is just adding to all of the issues that are going to be facing them right now. The army and the factional divisions are still very, very rife, and then the history, both long term and short term, of atrocities have left very deep scars. So trying to then deal with COVID. Nothing has happened, and so it's really bizarre. Gwen, you talked earlier about how we've seen instances of authoritarian regimes using the COVID crisis to reinforce their power. Well, here's quite the opposite, using their power to do nothing. What is the real impact? They kicked out who? The whole response team from the World Health Organization was kicked out of the country.
And this is Burundi specifically, or
out of Burundi, because they, the president, this very Nkurunziza, was claiming that they were spreading false rumors about how COVID was impacting them and what they should be doing when God was protecting them and they shouldn't be bothering him. So he, this is a tough one.
Quite a life. We can just finish it there and say that. President Nkurunziza, rest in peace, and the rest will.
I'm still trying to get a little bit more insight into the political comings and goings there, and we're going to try and get somebody on the air in the next couple of weeks to talk more about it, because it does go back a long way, including a spell in the late 90s, early 2000s, when Nelson Mandela and the group of African elder statesmen were part of the process of bringing around peace. So it's been long-standing, and it's been very complicated, and I certainly won't talk to it without somebody who knows more. Yes. More than I.
CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding@ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
As I said at the beginning of the show, it's good news that the Africa scene here in Montreal is still alive despite the COVID prohibition on spectacles and things. So instead of the Grand Nuit d'Afrique Festival, which usually takes 10 days and then brings artists from all over Africa and the diaspora, they're going to do Cabaret Acoustique Nuit d'Afrique at the Balatou Club, where over the course of Thursday to Friday, Sunday, over the next month, they will be bringing in all sorts of groups backed by the Orchestre Africain de Montréal. And so please give them your support. They're there on Saint-Laurent Boulevard, just above Marianne, and they've been an institution for years and years, and have kept the Africa scene, have been very much part of keeping the Africa scene alive and vibrant here. So that's my bit for Amanda this week. Thank you so much for being our listeners.
Thank you, everyone, and have a good night.
Thanks for listening, and stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
And don't forget the fundraiser. Oh, yes. We got to do the fundraiser. But you've heard the short, so make sure you contribute. Yo!
Papa dance. We do down Johannesburg way. And everybody starts to move as soon as Pata Pata starts to play.
Everybody, Derek Sege here. So we won't be hosting our families for the holidays this year, but let's look on the bright side. Got an aunt with some zany theories? Just mute her on the family video calls. A hippie cousin that bring new wave sludge to Réveillon? Not this year. To protect your family's health and safety, it's important you stay home and enjoy the peace and quiet.
Put your pants on, time to shovel the driveway.
Right away, hon. Safe holidays. Let's keep our spirits up.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Still looking for a holiday gift or two for the special people in your life? CKUT has new merch, including hoodies and t-shirts, that showcase classic designs dug up from our art attic. Head to ckut.ca to discover our new merch store and find out more about sizing and shipping. Happy holidays from all of us at CKUT.
Time.
C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K for
kitten.
Camp.
C, wait. Sunroof. C. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.